introduce our speaker, Mike Teske, and I'm not going to say much because I think we're in your studio, so I think this speaks more than words as an introduction. But I will say that some of the most beautiful recordings I've heard, or recordings that you shared with the local group, that come out of here, and so I think we're going to be hearing some tonight. Is that correct?
We will hear a couple of examples of music recorded here. We'll also hear a few brief clips of some other things, and we'll have two players. So we'll actually hear, not recording, we'll actually hear live people playing live music live. You can put all those lives in quotes, by the way.
So the basic thesis of the talk, as I understand it, is we're going to kind of discuss and investigate what is meant by reference, the term reference, mm-hmm. as it applies to audio. And I'm actually very curious myself, but that's one thing we're going to do. We're going to listen to a couple of performers perform live, and then we're going to listen to playback, not of that performance, but of a performance in the space that was done prior. Is that correct?
Yes, that's part of. That's going to be part of the presentation, the explanation thereof.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm just curious, but okay, that's all I have, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thanks.
Welcome to the studio.
Most of you have been here before, and it's really wonderful seeing you all back. A little bit about myself. I guess I didn't say anything. Yeah, didn't introduce myself. Mike Teske. My background is principally, at least on a formal level, principally in music. I have a bachelor and a master's in cello. I have a doctorate in conducting. As a player, I've played a lot of places, actually, both here in the United States and also in Europe. I think it may have said on the EAES blurb, you know, about this meeting, that I had at one time played at EMI Studios in England, you know, in London, in the late 60s, more became known as Abbey Road. What's intriguing about that was at the same time that we were there, I was in an orchestra, and they both conducted and was recorded there, and also played as the cellist there. At the same time, the Beatles were over here. when you're, at least when I was a kid, I didn't think about any of that. We were just so consumed with the music, so consumed with the activity, and the great opportunity of playing music, and heavens, going on this tour and playing over in Europe and many, many places. I actually was fortunate enough to be able to do that three times, three different tours. It's fascinating kind of looking back on that. And then I've composed and I've arranged. I've had a music publishing company. And so, as a player, we formed a quartet, actually, a string quartet. I'm a cellist on a good day. We've played for all kinds of things. And we've played, backup for many of the groups that have come to town, many of whom have not been classical groups. You know, you think cello, classical, but various types of popular rock or country or jazz or, you know, whether it's, one of the members of my quartet has a list of hundreds and hundreds of people, and my job is, I'm just trying to pay attention to not even this hour, but this moment, this very moment, you know. So I don't have a good catalog of what I've done in the past when it comes to playing with other people, but we have played with, you know, quite a number of other people. In audio, as a kid, I was always interested. And what is it that gets us interested? Well, we hear something we like, or we hear something that absolutely, not just like, absolutely has enormous impact on us. And for me, yes, it was a musical impact, but I was lucky. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. There was a particularly one gentleman, Ivan McWhorter, whose day job was teaching at Caltech. but whose daughter was a cellist. We were in an orchestra together. Ivan loved music, loved recording, and so he was one of those fellows. Unlike Rick, who and I understand fully, is not crazy about toting about those big, heavy, portable machines. You know, like an MPEX 300. But he did. He liked to record wherever he could. What did he use in those days? He used RCA 77s, may have used Altec Prees or something of that sort. By the way, well, I'm here, let me just spit. For those of you who say, what is that you refer to, Mike? That, for instance, is that's a 77DX. That one actually is from A&M Studios. That's a ribbon mic, and it was used very frequently. One of the examples I'm going to play shortly was actually recorded into an RCA ribbon mic. They have tremendous response. They're very, what I mean by that, trenchant response. Accuracy within their given range is good. It's really, really good. In some ways, from my standpoint, a bit preferable, actually, to the condenser mics that we use. And I love some of the condenser mics, whether the Neumanns or the DPAs, and later on you're going to hear Catherine. You'll hear a Blu-ray of Catherine. The Blu-ray, well, she was recorded using a couple of DPA 4006s. If you're not familiar with that, they're very, very, a lot of people refer to them as reference microphones. And they're good. What goes in comes out. It's supposed to be a superb transducer from acoustical to electrical and so forth. Well, anyway, Ivan McWhorter got me onto audio. Ivan McWhorter taught me how to build amps, preamps, and so forth. When we talk about amps and preamps and that kind of thing, we're talking about tube equipment back then. I don't know if it's an old or a young, but I am 71. And so, I've been around, and by golly, I'm having a birthday, God willing, this year, too. So, the number just keeps going up.
You don't look anywhere near that, Mike.
No, you don't.
Oh, well, thank you.
90.
Well, I guess it's... if Mom and Dad were here, you could thank them. But, the thing that's intrigued me, not just this year, not just for a while, but it's the concept of, as you may recall, those of you old enough, for those who are familiar anyway with the old movie, What's It All About, Alfie? Why do we do what we do? Well, we know we do what we do because we love music and we love recording. Some people are just gearheads. Some of us are just techies. Some of us, there's just something about it that really draws us. And again and again. And we love to see the improvements. We love to see the development of things, particularly in our own spheres. We may start off with something that's, I don't know, some little itty-bitty device that may be quite limited in its ability to capture sound. And then we may acquire tools of the trade that enable us to do better, to get closer and closer to the source. What is it that we're trying to do? Well, we have a large community within a subsection of the audio industry called mastering engineers who take something and those of you who are principally mastering engineers, you can correct me if you feel as if this is a misrepresentation, but the idea is to take something and render it in a most acceptable manner for public consumption, shall we say. In other words, it's usually a commercial endeavor, and there are technical parameters, and then there are purely personal parameters. What are those purely personal? Well, it may be as simple as that individual mastering engineer's preference. It may not be. It may be that, but it may be based upon a great deal of experience and learning about the auditory sense, about maybe an artist's preference, the guy who actually, or the people who made the recording. You know, there's quite an admixture that can go in there. But one of the commonalities you'll find in most available music is that it's been treated in some way, somehow. It's not just a mic picking up something, or a number of microphones picking up something, and then you simply hear that playback. Something else has been done. maybe where the sound has been located, panned, whatever, levels, EQ, you know, these are fundamentals. There are a lot of stuff can be done. We actually have now, I don't know, thousands? That's that conservative? Thousands of tools. I think it's not an exaggeration to say we have, if we were to deal with all the permutations, millions of permutations that we could, of adjustments or changes that we can apply to sound. Often you hear it said, well, yes, but we're trying to get it closer to what it sounds. We want it to sound like what it sounds like. Like we want to have been there. When we hear this, we play it back on our, whether it's a home theater system, what's that, last 20 years, theater system, home, you know, our audio system. Whether we now, particularly now, we listen to it in our earbuds or our over-the-ear, you know, some sort of a ear speaker, as it were. However it is we listen, you'll find a commonality in the concept and the idea of, well, we'd like it to sound like it sounded. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes somebody has an imaginative concept. They go into a studio and they try to realize this concept. Whether that actually occurred in nature or not, it may have, it may not have. To invalidate that idea in any way, shape, or form is, in my opinion, a mistake. There's an enormous amount of validity to imagination. Silly to suggest otherwise. What I'm going to do now is, for me, kind of a risky business. I'm going to begin with this is my PowerPoint presentation. So let me see if we can get this thing active.
We might?
Yes.
One side comment? There's been a drastic change in the last years where I think originally you did mastering, you had like people like Bernie Grudman. When we talk mastering, we're talking 45s and LPs, and you know, does it the record sound like the RCA studio? Does your A&M have their own sound, things like that?
Yeah.
To a situation now where I think in many cases the end result is something that they can take from place to place to place that sounds the same, so they can master it in one. Let's say from a Grammys, they can master it in one trailer, move it to another trailer, and there's no difference in the sound, or they can take it from one studio to another. And because it's all digitized and carries all the basic information, it's lost all the acoustics and the things that we used to use 30 years ago that made it unique, and makes it very dry today. And if you sit and listen to people like talking about the Grammys, their big thing, when I was at AES, their big thing for last year was they had 6 trailers, and every one of the trailers had the sound alike, because when they made a cut, when they did the pre-show work, in one from one trailer, they may not get back into that trailer again to tweak it.
Paul,
all of them had sound.
What you're describing,
situations where we wiped out a lot of the ingenuity, a lot of the.
You're describing a uniformity,
yeah,
or, as it were, in addition, a conformity, and so the individual, the distinctiveness, is a real issue. It's a real issue. This is not a commentary on digital. This is a commentary on the use, the usage.
Digital makes it easier because you can always carry some information with you that makes it easier to move it between places.
True.
You know, whereas we didn't have that.
And repeatability.
Yeah.
For instance, in this studio, as we're going to demonstrate, Catherine recorded here on the 29th of December. We're going to play that, right after which we'll listen to her play the same piano in the same location, not the same room in that you were in it and you weren't here that 29th of December, and I didn't have this covering up this end of the piano. There was. That's, you know what I'm trying to say. There are some changes, but this room, unlike most rooms, is less affected by those changes. It is, but less affected. So, for what that's worth. Maybe, I don't know, somewhere on that wall, I believe, or on the door, it indicates there are 16,300 pounds of rock wool on the lateral planes, and actually there's some above and between walls and so forth. So it's a controlled acoustical environment. So whatever occurs in here...
stays in here.
There's
less change, shall we say. All righty, I don't really need to hold
Mike,
this
you're
right
not a Chip
now.
Davis facility, are you? Hey, Mike, you didn't have Chip Davis work on this at all, did you?
I beg your pardon?
You didn't have Chip Davis work on this at all, did you?
No, this is my idea.
Your idea?
Okay. I had Cooper, who did Sony Studios initially. We had a wonderful idea, but I didn't like it because I'm kind of an old school guy. I don't like the idea. We were going to have a three room environment here, larger area there, two drum room and the vocal and so forth. I still have the plans to it, but the more I looked at it, the more I thought, just one more of those. The problem was simple. It's fundamental. I need enough air molecules. I just have to have them. That's just something you can't get around. I want the room to be able to sustain certain levels of sound pressure before it starts to, you know, it is fundamentals, you know. So anyway, but it wasn't a bad design. All right. Reference. Oh, look at that. It's actually working thus far.
Beautiful job on your power on your first PowerPoint, Mike.
There's more to it. Let's just wait a moment here, folks. We hear somebody say, I use as my reference. Might be a microphone, might be a loudspeaker. Or maybe this reference recording. When I go to listen to this or that, I use this reference recording. Now, you all are aware, with very, very few exceptions, though there are some exceptions, of the enormous quantity of unknowns that go with the production, unknowns to the person who uses that as a reference recording, that go with the production of that reference recording. What is it referring to, or what are they referring to? Probably what they mean is, well, I know it, and I like it, and I've heard it many times. That's it. My idea, let me continue a little bit. A reference may be a thought. That's it, just a thought. It may be a visual. It may be something audible to which we can refer. But it's usually something. For our purposes here, we're talking about the audible. We're talking about the oral. Not exclusively. What Steve mentioned, and what Bob jokingly, though not entirely jokingly, mentioned, was smell-o-vision. The tactile. All of the senses. Again, we're concerned about the oral, but I wouldn't want to close my mind to the others. I think that would be a mistake. The visual in our society particularly seems to dominate. How do you sell a record? Well, I guess you make a video. Oh, there's something I like, you know, attached to it. I know this is maybe being a little bit hyperbolic on my part, but often it seems like without that visual, music may not have a chance, you know, if it's on YouTube, for instance.
Hey.
All right. For our purposes, reference is a capture system. Microphone, electromechanical reproduction, and the acoustical environment of something we've heard and then we want to reproduce. We want to rehear it again. Surely that's not the only, but that is a fundamental definition of reference. You know, whether it's the radiation of a voice, and when I say the radiation of a voice, straight on I sound this way. That same guy, me, talking that way, over here, as you well know, I don't sound quite the same. It's different. Same thing applies to a piano. To loud, if someone uses, say, a loudspeaker, i.e. somebody uses a guitar amp, even the guitar amp, depending upon where you're at, even though it's electromechanical, it's same thing. What's an exception to the radiation pattern issue when we're talking about a reference? An exception would be if we use oscillators or we use some sort of electronic means to generate our sound initially. Everything, as it were, is generated and created and finalized in the box. Well, we may have a reference that's electronic that certainly within one reference is legitimate. This is a reference. So that is a possibility. The word itself, well, it's from the Middle English referum, Latin referre. What does it mean? What's the fundamental there? It's to carry back, to link to connect to. A reference work we hear often. In art, I'm talking about pictorial or visual, it's a directly observed object. Not just pictorial, though, not just visual. Again, it can be acoustical, directly observed. Or it could simply be the artist's memory of something. Sometimes that's how it is. We're relying upon our memory. We do rely upon our memory. We heard this great concert. We have such a wonderful memory of that concert. I am advocating, not as an exclusive, but certainly as perhaps the fundamental idea, the old classic Greek yardstick, that man is the measure, not the electronically reproduced, even though they can be magnificent studio reproductions, studio creations, and there have been so many. In fact, what is almost assumed now is that music is created in a studio. That's our, that's the workplace. I have a studio, and we do capture here, where we try to make it sound as it sounded, and then we sometimes do not do that. Sometimes somebody says, no, this is what I have in mind. Can we make it sound like the mountains and the thises and the thats? And so, you come up with an oral landscape. I suppose you could argue, or you could say, that's what do we call it in theater? Not theater sound, but
sound
help
design.
Me out. We have a modern term for that. People go to school and learn those things. Dave, what do you call
Sonography?
It? No. Oh, well, 71, I got an excuse.
Ambience?
What we want in this classic definition is for A to equal A, for the performance and then the playback or art, then later on re-listening to be the same.
Nope.
At least that's what I'm suggesting would make an intelligent reference. So that means it sounds, what we hear on playback, sounds identical to the actual players as they played. How do you do that? Well, what if you're moving about the room as they're playing? Obviously, as I mentioned a moment ago, it changes. The whole perception, the auditory experience, changes. If you go, whether it's a classical or a jazz or a rock concert, it's pretty infrequent that you're able to do that. It's pretty infrequent that you're able to move around on stage, behind, and so forth. When I was designing the studio, Dana Kirkegaard of Kirkegaard & Associates, those are the guys who did Chicago Symphony, Boston, some other of the major halls in the United States. Dana invited me to Chicago. He says, listen, let me show you what we did with Chicago Symphony. So I actually went. And during a performance of the Chicago Symphony, a great orchestra, during the performance, Dana said, here, let's go over here. We're running all over the hall. What am I doing? Just during a real performance, not on stage, by the way, but all over the place.
Is this before or so, after they raised the roof?
But that is quite an unusual experience. You don't often have that opportunity. I would say it is an opportunity, even though it's also a potential incredible embarrassment. But anyway, so and on playback, there are obvious things. You want the sound pressure level to be the same. You want the dynamic range to be the entire, experience to be identical. Fine. This is kind of a reiteration, but when you're capturing it, you want the pickup chain from A to Z, and then the reproduction of that to be the same. A equals A. Okay. When you play it back, say there you are, I don't know, in town, say you're at Tula's, you're at Highway 99, or you're at Benaroya Hall, or wherever you are, you're at the theater. And it's, there's something there that you liked, and someone recorded it. When you get a chance to listen to that, do you listen to it at Benaroya Hall or at Tula's or at Highway 99? No, usually you're hearing it in your home or your car or your earbuds or, you know, whatever. Very different acoustical environment. I mean, just, you know, a whole new set of parameters, really. But you want it to sound the same, at least going by the criteria that I postulated. Very tough to do. So, obviously, the primary factors that influence that, acoustical environment, which I just mentioned, your auditory perspective, sound source, your capture equipment, what is done, say, in the box or in post, tracking, mixing, mastering, so forth, and then in your home, what is it you're playing it back on? Other human things, auditory fatigue. What if you're tired? What if you're tired during the concert you play it back? What if just the human condition varies? It's tough for A to equal A. Very tough. Temperature and humidity. You say, oh, well, that's not minor if you played cello. It's not. It's not minor even for the piano in this studio. Day A, say day Monday, you record. Not something that's going to hammer the instrument out of tune. You play something that's kind to the instrument. Next day, you go in there, but say it's been raining cats and dogs, or say the humidity or something has changed. The instrument may change. Is it only the instrument? Could the room change? All I know is that it's been perceptible, those differences, 24 hours. You know. So it'd be silly for me to ignore that. But what if we could find out what Domenico Scarlatti, what he sounded like, what he would like it to sound like? What if we could capture the past? What if we could capture him? An example. Except that wasn't Scarlatti, that wasn't played, and well, he was born in 1685 and he died in 1757, that's quite a while ago. The piano, we just heard a piano, was a Steinway, didn't exist then. Of course, our ability to record, what ability? So what do we know? Well, we have the manuscript, we have maybe some text, people describe this or that about the times and so forth. We have our imagination. Our imagination, after all is said and done, springs from, well, the notation, what he wrote down. How did he play? How did he, you know? Well, we don't know. We weren't there. We're not there now, but we weren't at all there then. By the same token, Bach. What would it have been like? What would Bach have, how would he have played the organ? How would he have played a keyboard instrument? And how would he have reacted to how it is now? We don't know. But thank you.
I would be remiss not mentioning who those two performers were. The first was Murray Pariah.
Murray Pariah is an American pianist, one of the great modern pianists. Mm. Who recorded this? It's recorded in Germany. First-class engineers. Is that a replication of what it really sounded like in that hall? Actually, no. No, if you actually study how that was recorded, it's kind of interesting. They were going for a kind of sound. So there was some imaginings involved there. To say it was a bad sound would be absurd. Pretty good sound, I'd say. And with a remarkably gifted pianist. The second pianist is a Deutsche Grammophon recording. That's of Marta Argerich. One could argue pretty darn easily one of the greatest pianists of all time, period. Is she alive now? Yeah. She just turned 75, by the way. Bit of a character in the eyes of some. Does she show up for every concert she's scheduled to play? Is he, you know, well, whatever. No, the answer is no, by the way. But that's it's not like she's just totally whimsical. No, not at all. But one great, great pianist. People most know her technique. Just incredible technique. It's a heck of a lot more than that. A great musician. But that's Bach. What would Bach have thought? How would he have done it? What would he, you know? To write that music. Now remember, Bach also was born in 1685, same year that our friend Scarlatti was born. Bach died in 1750. What are we talking about? 1275, way, way long ago within our lifetimes. But to write a piece of music to some composers, to creative people, it's a kind of giving birth. It's a kind of, it's your child. It matters. What do you have in mind? Do you have in mind for somebody to take it and do whatever they want with it? You may. You may not. You may have something specific. We don't know. As people who try to capture, as recordists, it would be fantastic if we were able to capture what it was. For instance, Paganini sounded like. If you say, well, who's Paganini? Niccolo Paganini was the greatest Western culture virtuoso of the 19th century. Incredible. A lot of people thought this guy was in league with the devil. And you say, oh, come on, in league with the devil, what are you? His appearance, the way he played, the just whole world of technique on the violin, which simply didn't exist prior to him. I mean to say, amazing. Here's a little excerpt. This is Yascha Heifetz performing Paganini, I think it's Caprice number 20. Just the next That actually is an arrangement. The piano part didn't exist. Paganini didn't write that. Heifetz, interesting, didn't play too many of these Paganini caprices in public. Heifetz is regarded by some as maybe the greatest violinist, depending on who you talk to. You know. But certainly an absolutely astounding violinist. What would it have been like to hear Paganini? What would it have been like to have been there and to totally recapture the sound of Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address? What would it have been like? We don't know. We weren't there. We couldn't capture it. We just don't know. And to what extent? What does the job? One mic in front of him. Oh, it's not a total transduction, but it's close enough. We understand easily what he says. or the entire atmosphere, the entire everything about it. I would be fascinated by that. By the way, in the Gettysburg Address, I'm not getting political here, I'm making an observation. So, when I went to school, remember, not a young guy, when I went to school, we initially learned the Pledge of Allegiance, and it did not contain under God. 1954, they included under God. Not coincidentally, during the MacArthur era. All right, but in the Gettysburg Address, though, Lincoln says, and I'm just starting in the middle of the thing, you know, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, etc. Just interesting. I wonder how he intoned it. I wonder what the presumptions were, what the acceptances were. I wonder just the whole thing. We don't know. Who's been in the news lately? Well, the dead guy died in 1955, Albert Einstein, who has got to be on about everybody's top 10 science list, you know, of all time, you know. I mean, absolutely amazing conceptually, the thought, the concept. He was a violinist. He was an amateur violinist, but he was a violinist. He loved violin. He loved music. He played with, by the way, Hackett's played with him. Piatigorsky, the great cellist, played with him. Tush Seidel played with him. Tush Seidel was a great, great violinist. You say, who's that? If you listen to a lot of the old classical scores from Hollywood, from the 30s and 40s and 50s, who's that great violinist who's playing those solos? It's Tush Seidel. He was a concertmaster at Paramount. He taught Einstein some lessons. He gave him some lessons. Over the table, lunch, he says, I got to repay you. Seidel, by the way, was a great chess player. A lot of people know him. He was an excellent, excellent chess player. So he wrote, Einstein wrote on a napkin something even today is cryptic to most, but certainly in 1934 it was pretty darn cryptic. But what it was length contraption, contraction, which is a major detail, more than detail, in the theory of relativity. It's fascinating. By the way, this is the same guy who says, look, you don't really know, you can't claim to really understand something, this Einstein, unless you can clearly explain it to, I believe he said, your grandmother. Interesting comment. The thing about Seidel I just want to mention is I was fortunate enough, our family was fortunate enough to have Seidel as a good friend. I mean, he was over at the house, and in fact, his quartet gave the premiere of my father's string quartet at USC way back when. Heck of a guy. But we don't know what that conversation sounded like. We're thinking, you know, in this room we always think music, music, music. I think music, music, music in this room usually. But the auditory experience may be birds. I was driving back from California after going to a CES. I stopped in Northern California for whatever the reason was. I think I wanted to actually just stretch my legs. It was in Northern California, one of those rest stops. I got out. They have, you know, some trees and the rest stop. And I heard this incredible sound. I looked up and there were just, it appeared to be thousands of birds in these, not large trees, but...
I know the rest stop. I've been there many times.
It is staggering. And you hear the sound of this bird, of the birds. Not just any old birds, not just any old sound. It is astounding. I heard this. That's meaningful to me. It was extraordinary. Birds? Yeah, birds. The sound of Louis Simpson reading his own poetry. The sound of Broadway. Sound of a lot of things. By the way, I have some discs, just ornithological discs. I'm not a bird watcher, by the way. It's just the sound that's interesting. Yeah.
We used to certify noiseworthiness of jets and teach acoustics to FAA people. And one of the things that would cut through all the recordings, where'd that bird come from? Not that plane drowned it out.
I think that very likely all of you would have been really impressed by that sound. And it was so songful. It was like they were all songbirds. I don't know my birds, so I don't know what kind of birds they were. Bird talk. Anyway.
What kind of reproduction system would you need?
You know what I used? I had a phone. And I recorded it. It's better than nothing.
It's a reminder.
But where does it really reside? It's not
in
here.
In that moment, actually.
Well, it's in that moment. And it's in my memory. Mm-hmm. Really. It's not this. It helps, but... Yeah. Martin Luther King, I wasn't there. What would it have been like? And would we have the ability to go front, to go back, left, right, to hear the crowd's reaction, to hear him? Now, of course, there was a playback system. He was speaking into a mic. It was amplified. You know, there was a lot of... There were many, many people there at the Washington Monument. What would it have been like? You've heard about the Watts riots, 1965 in Los Angeles. I'm not from Beverly Hills. I'm from Los Angeles, but I'm not from Beverly Hills. I was raised in Compton, California. In 1965, I was in an orchestra. I mentioned earlier and had the opportunity to tour. 1965 was in an orchestra. We were rehearsing, actually, at USC. And at USC, in those days, it was not, again, Beverly Hills. It was a little seedy on the outskirts of that area. And this whole thing happened. And we were surrounded by gunshots. Where's it coming from? Who's doing it? Who's going to be victimized? Do bullets go through sheetrock? Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Scary. The experience, an awful lot of that experience was oral, just oral, what you heard. Wouldn't it be something if we could recapture that? You say, well, I don't want to recapture that. Mm-hmm. I could easily understand that. So, anyway, then there's the real world. What's the real world? Well, we make CDs, we make files, we make high res and so forth. And the emphasis is on how much better the high res file is. By the way, here, as a matter of course, we usually make 2496 or 9624, whatever your preference is, recordings. We can do 192, we can do 1-bit, we can do all that. I, my own experience is that overall, either 2496 or sometimes 2448 is fine. That's just my experience anyway. So most people say, well, this is all well and good, this pie-in-the-sky stuff you're talking about, Mike, and what does that have to do with anything, really? The industry, the music industry, is characterized most easily and most specifically as a business. What is the business? To sell, to make money, to profit. By the way, how's that going? Anybody in the business right now? Not so good. Could it possibly be related to how we're treating whatever it is that's recorded music? To possibly the almost innumerable number of files that when you look at the waveform looks like extruded toothpaste. What happened to the life? What happened to the dynamics?
Mastering.
It very well may be mastering. It might even be before that. It could be that the mastering engineer says, what is this you're giving me? You know, it could be. Yeah.
One of the challenges that has been constantly on my mind here is when people take mixes and they reference their mixes to mastered works, exactly. Which are completely different things exactly. In the game structure. You might be getting to that. But that they're even, you know, mixed with the... There's software that you can put in chunks that you can go back and forth between your mix and whatever other file you're referring to. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing a reference, if you have it at the same stage of the production chain, that would be a good idea instead of taking the end of the production chain and referring.
You know, Steve, I wasn't actually, I was going to just teensy-tiny mention that or touch upon that. Because I'm afraid all the mastering engineers are going to think I'm against them and all that.
That's isn't it. Ground zero.
But you're actually thing. On a... That's a big point.
It's the thing that makes what we call a half-baked pie. because you've got mixing is like mixing a pie, and then mastering is like baking the pie. Mm-hmm. And people try and get the pie sounding like it should go on the radio before it's sent to the mastering engineer, then we have to pull it back down and restore it.
All of that is a real thing that is happening so frequently. Yeah. And I believe I have it up here. Maybe the summary is, give them what motivates people to push play and what are the presumptions. Well, look at what other people have done. And that seemed to have worked, whether that was, whether it happened, there are a lot of reasons why people are successful or why maybe they aren't.
Or what do I love?
What do I love?
Because that's the motivation that you have to share that with people.
So whatever it is, there are commercial motivations. What are the commercial motivations? Well, they motivate 99%+ of whatever is actually produced. I'll tell you what, we're going to have a time when we are going to do some discussion. I do have an 11-year-old here, and I'm considering the fact that she may even have homework. Can you imagine that, going to school, having homework? It can happen. So I'm going to kind of move on just a little bit, okay? But we will have a point, though, where we will have some discussion, Paul. So my reference, cutting to the chase, is very much analogous to what we all are familiar with, or almost all of us are familiar with, which is the holodeck idea, the Star Trek reference. There's a slight change, though, because that's referred to as virtual reality by many people. The reason I say there's a slight change is virtual reality. By the way, I was at CES, and I saw all the virtual reality offerings and so forth, which I was interested in. Conceptually, very attractive, conceptually. Virtual there means, well, you kind of see stuff that looks like it's 3D. You kind of hear stuff, maybe, depending on who's doing it, that has kind of a 3D, locational differences and highs and lows and lefts and rights and distances and nears and all that sort of thing. But virtual there, you can't reach out and touch it. You can't smell it. You can't taste it. You can't shake its hand. You can't. I don't believe I heard anything that enabled me, as we moved around visually, to, in the same manner, acoustically move around. I didn't see anything like that. Not there yet. But as an idea, though, I like that idea. Now, we're getting into maybe some laws and physics problems here, could be. How do you recreate something that happened that's already happened? Again, I'm being simplistic. I'm talking in classical Newtonian terms, and I don't want to get too far out here, but let's bear with me, okay? How can we, right now, be also in something that was in the past, but we have, to such an extent, recreated it that it's also now? Corporeally. Tough. Is it impossible? It's not easy. No one's done it, to my knowledge. But that would be an interesting challenge. So, as a recordist, I like that idea. I find that more interesting. I don't find it interesting when the guy says, even though it can be legitimate, you're in your open-air car, you're going 70 miles an hour, you won't hear that soft stuff. And they're right. Compressing that, raising the bottom so that that threshold point will always be a little bit above the road noise, otherwise there's a problem. You can't hear it. Maybe you like it that way. Truth is, many of us don't. We actually would like to be able to hear something that is on a disc, as it were, or is on a file that we play, or whatever. So, what we're going to do now is we're going to give a very simple demonstration. We're already in the first part of that demonstration. You hear the room as it sounds right now. That's our room. Give me just a moment. I have to reawake my my layers. Why are we doing this? Because in a moment, Catherine's going to play. And she's going to play in one of these rooms. She said, what do you mean rooms? Sure. Hopefully. Yeah. Hello? Different room. That's just go to room number.
Yes, lexicon.
I'll go back and forth and see if I can. Yeah.
So here we go.
That's the room we're in. The small layers room. You say, what do you mean small? Well, it is, but the presence of the room sound, I can vary. What if you say, it's too much, Mike? Okay. Hello? So you can adjust things of that sort to suit. Okay. Well, you say, how about a little larger room? Hello? How about a room akin to, this room would be slightly smaller than Benaroya. Slightly. Very close. Hello? Somewhere like that. Except it wouldn't have as much presence of the room sound. Benaroya doesn't. Have any of you played on the stage or done, you know. And when you're up there, what you hear really is closer to, I remember doing a recording session there, and actually it was pretty good. I was surprised because sometimes when I go there, I think, but this is, I like the sound. So it depends, just all depends. Hello? A little more than that. That's a little shy. Mm-hmm. Hello? Well, maybe. We can dial in to suit. Okay, and then the last room I'm just going to demonstrate quickly is. Hello? Cathedral. Dome in the center. Sound rises toward the dome. But what we're going to do is we're going to listen. Hello? You're not there. Good. the ghost in the machine. Let me flip this. And what I'd like to do would be to play for you. Let me see if I'm getting ahead of myself. Well, I haven't caught up with myself. All right, then we did the large room, and then we did the very large, the layers. And by the way, layers, in case you say, well, what is that? I know some of you already know. Layers refers to lexicon, acoustical reinforcement, and enhancement system. In this room, we have 72 loudspeakers. We have two Shep's mics. It could have had four. It actually is a little bit better with just two rather than four mics here to pick up whatever is the sound in the room. It goes through a lot of pajabber back there that's housed in electronic boxes. Comes out through the loudspeakers. By the way, one simple thing about this concept, in order for it to work, is one, you do not want to have standing waves building up. If you do, it's not going to work whatsoever. That would be more akin to, you go to the big church with all their electronic gear and everything's amplified, you hear this, that, and the rest squeal all the time because somebody doesn't know how to, whatever, you know. We can't have that. We can actually dial in about 100, and I think the way we have it calibrated right now, I think it's about 121 dB before feedback. It's pretty loud. We're okay. There's a couple other things I wanted to mention about layers. Oh, number two, the sound needs to be equally distributed. What does that mean? It has to be essentially invisible. The last thing you want to be able to do is say, oh, I hear that sound coming from right there. To be able to localize a room sound is silly. Silly. It doesn't work. Three, in order for it to work at all, your electronics have got to be quiet. We've got 72 loudspeakers. Do you hear them? No. But you have to have good electronics. Also, the loudspeakers, each one of them, have to have an even and wide radiating pattern. Some beam. Beaming is not good. Not good for this kind of thing. In fact, beaming sometimes, sometimes it's very useful, but not in this case, not at all. Okay, so I'm going to turn on that small room. Well, I'm not going to do that yet, excuse me. I'm going to play a Blu-ray. It will be of our young, dear Catherine. Something we shot here the 29th of December, and it was with Catherine playing this piano. It's going to be the same piece she's going to play in just a moment. But what we're going to do is we're going to play this, And then I want to turn on the room, and before we have conversation, immediately hear Catherine play the piece. Let's make some comparison.
Was the room turned on in the original recording?
Good question. Yes. We did several takes. We had some where it wasn't on at all. That was back then. Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah.
And it would be similar to what we're going to see.
Oh, if it's not resettable, if we can't, then we have a problem, Houston. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go to that. You'll note a resemblance. One mention. These speakers for the sound to kind of coalesce. You should be about 18 feet away and you should be centered. I'm standing over here thinking, gee, it's kind of bass heavy over here. You know? Yeah. Radiation pattern. But also, it's not entirely an excuse that if you're here, it's going to be all great. No. No, it's not. It's not perfect.
It's our reference.
Well, now, our reference. And this is a legitimate statement. This is our reference.
Can you turn it on?
Give me just a moment, Catherine. Okay. And by the way, I want to say this is fantastic that she can just sit down and play. I need to warm up as a player. I think it's just wonderful. I don't know how they do it. I don't know.
Kids these days.
This is in this room without any room sound. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, maybe first phrase or, you know, whatever.
Excellent.
And Mike, the input to the Lara system is right here, these 414s? Or
No, not 414s are to pick up your voice.
What's the input? The Lara system.
Sheps and Sheps.
Thank you.
Cardioid, by the way.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it is. I said, why not on me? Steve explained. Steve Barber's principal at Lara's. Anyway, all right. So, did it sound the same, the recorded, and then the real thing? How are we going to do that?
And then the different room as well.
And we did the different room.
There's three references.
Well, two references. But if you say the Blu-ray, that would make three. But is the Blu-ray a reference? The Blu-ray is an attempt. But for people to go around saying that's a reference, well, I guess you can use it as a reference, but for me, and maybe you could say, man, you're an old, stuffy, what are you thinking? Come on, get modern. No, that is not the reference. This is the reference. Catherine playing in whichever acoustical environment we have, right? Now that is a reference. That I can relate to. Pun intended, by the way.
So you're calibrating your ears. And you're calibrating your sensory situation while you're listening to these.
Now, there are some of you who might say, well, you know what the problem is, Mike. Your mics aren't properly positioned. Or these loudspeakers, my God, the design is from, you know, this is a Western Electric design, for God's sake. You know. Fine. By the way, Western Electric design ain't all that bad, as you may well know. But I recognize their limits, shall we say. Any loudspeaker. Sometimes, even with superb, superb loudspeakers, when you listen long enough, it just starts sounding like a box. I'm sorry. I wish it weren't so. Even if it's not a box. Quads. Sometimes, I have quads. In fact, if you'll note, I don't know if you can see them, I had a couple of thingies here and here and over there. I had quads suspended in here. I used to use them as reference. The problems, we once had 32 musicians in here, and I needed every little bit of space, you know, because big instruments and all that. So I don't have them in here now. It doesn't matter what the loudspeaker is. I hate to say it. We haven't quite come up with the perfect loudspeaker, folks, whatever that may be. But this is part of our discussion. Now, let me look at our time here. It's 8:57. I have another example I want to play for you. And I'm not sure if this is the right moment to take a break. But Zoe, how are you doing on time? Can we take a break then come back and do that?
Sure.
You're okay with that? Okay. Zoe is going to be our next performer. It's going to be a very interesting piece of music, too. It's more contemporary. It's got special effects and so forth in it. And what we did on that, giving you a little prelude here, is we recorded it 16th, does that sound right? Tuesday night? And, I guess it would be, 16th, 8 days ago. While Zoe was playing, we changed room sounds. Number one, from dry progressively to wet. I didn't want to get too confused, so that's the progression. Number two, it was a two-camera shoot. The camera that is more of a close-up on Zoe, has an auditory perspective, more, you would think, closer to what that would be if you were standing where that camera seems to be, closer to her. The one that's further, different auditory perspective. You will hear it. You'll witness it. These are lame attempts at trying to get real. Mm-hmm. They're lame because they're imperfect. They're interesting nonetheless. And by the way, I did. There's a certain amount of hyperbole in this particular example, too. So I confess to that right from the get-go. Why don't we do this? And I'm thinking particularly of Catherine. Thank you so much for playing. Why don't we take a break right now? Let's go get some yummy food. Or, you know, we've got some good cake, actually. I didn't make it. Costco did.
We should get Catherine.
Absolutely. Please. Where's Catherine's mom?